of the previous chapter, chapter 12, verse 31, and read down through the text if you don't mind. But earnestly desire the greater gifts, and I show you a still more excellent way. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mystery and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it does not provoke, it does not take into account wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child and think like a child and reason like a child. But when I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully just as I also have been fully known. But now abides faith, hope, and love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. With that setting in mind, I want you to go over to John the 13th chapter and notice that in John the 13th chapter, Jesus is observing the Passover supper one last time with his 12 apostles. And I want to suggest that as he did that, he knew exactly what lay before him. He knew that his hour had come, the hour for him to depart out of the world and go to the Father. He knew that very soon he would leave these men to go to a place where they couldn't follow him. But Jesus also knew about the flawed character of these men. He knew that these men were not perfect. And he knew that in spite of the fact that he had spent nearly 3 years trying to train them and encourage them and prepare them for the task he had ahead of them. And there are a number of ways in which you could remember or see and understand the flawed character of these men. I think one of the examples that come to my mind the most is the fact that they were men who struggled, who longed for a position and place in the coming kingdom. They fought about, for example, more than once, they fought about who among them was the greatest. And Jesus spoke to that in Matthew or Mark the 9th chapter and then in Mark the 10th chapter on both of those occasions when they had argued about that. They would argue about it again on the very evening that we're talking about in John 13. If you look at Luke's account, Luke 22 suggests that they argued on that very evening again about the subject of who among them was the greatest. And it may very well have been that event that caused Jesus to take a towel and stoop down and wash his disciples' feet. Jesus certainly knew about the flawed character of these men. So Jesus knew what was ahead of him. He knew about the flawed character of these men, but Jesus also knew something else. He knew what he was about to commission these men to do. He knew that he was about to send these men, these flawed men, on a mission to take his saving message to the rest of the world, the only message that could save them, the gospel of his salvation. And Jesus really needed these guys to succeed. And the reason he needed them to succeed was because he had no alternate plan. If these guys didn't get the job done, there was no other group of people to send. And so Jesus knew about their flawed nature, but he also knew what he was going to do, that he was going to send them on this very, very important mission. How could such faulty men, how could they accomplish such great a task? Especially with the fact that their Lord was no longer going to be with them. He was going to leave them. There was only one way. For them to succeed, they were going to have to put away their petty jealousies and their silly disputes, and they were going to have to learn to really lean on one another. And it is in that context of John 13, which I think is also one of the great New Testament texts, it is in that context that Jesus gives a new commandment. He says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Jesus is saying to them that in order for them to accomplish their task, it was critical for them to love one another. Mutual love was essential. It was going to be their badge of discipleship that would distinguish them as the authentic followers of Jesus, His authentic disciples. It would also be the glue, as it were, that would bind them together, that would hold them together. This quality would hold them together in a world that was trying to tear them, that would try to tear them apart. It was going to be the key to their success. And I would suggest to you that some 2,000 years later, love is still just as imperative among the authentic disciples of Jesus Christ as it was among those early, those very first disciples who were first sent out with the saving message of Jesus Christ. Unfortunately, as you know, we live in a world and in an age that misunderstands the love that Jesus requires of His disciples. Our world mistakes syrupy words and empty flattery and touchy-feely emotions, and some even mistake sensual passion for love. Our world doesn't know what love is all about. Thankfully, though, our Lord has given us instructions with regard to what this thing called love really looks like. And that, of course, is found in this passage that is the text that I've been assigned to, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 to 13. Here in this text, love is described as a more excellent way, and it's actually described in a context in which it is a more excellent way, even that a way that supersedes the way of the miraculous gifts. It is a way that is even greater than other things that are mentioned in the text, like faith and hope. Among these, it is the greatest of all. Jesus is wanting us to understand, through His Apostle Paul as he writes, He wants us to understand what love is all about. And so we're going to take the time to try to examine that today. Now, I'm going to share with you a little something. I tried to lay this on the brethren at Paris Avenue in Peoria last Sunday night. And it was too much information to try to get into the sermon. And obviously trying to see how this was going to go. And my wife and I have a kind of a thing that we do. We've done it for years. Whenever I get finished preaching, I sit down next to her, or we get in the car, and I say, well, how did it go? And she'll say, well, in baseball terms, well, it was a double, or, you know, it was a triple, or once in a while, it's a home run. And I really like that. We got in the car on Sunday night, and my son, my youngest son, who's still at home, Caleb, he says, well, Dad, you drew a walk tonight. And so it really kind of blew up in my face. It didn't work out so well, and so I had to rework things. And what I want you to understand is because of time constraints, I'm going to have to try to, I hope it's not going to just be a walk, maybe at least a single tonight, today, but I'm going to have to take out a lot of some of the things that I wanted to talk about. But I want to focus a lot tonight on the 13th chapter, and particularly the reasons why Paul makes the point in the particular context that he does. And I really want to spend a few minutes trying to make application of the things that he has to say. And so that's what we're going to do tonight, this afternoon or this morning, whatever it is. We're going to try to do that today. I also find myself getting extremely nervous in these kinds of circumstances. As I go on, I'll probably get a little less nervous. Very often in a situation like this, I try to maybe read the notes too much, and I don't want to do that. I'm going to do what Carl Dieselkamp always used to tell me. He'd say, Rick, just read it back and preach. So I'm going to try to do that today. So let's think a little bit about the context and the point that the Apostle Paul is making and the application that it can have to us. You know, when you read the Corinthian letter, you realize that the Corinthians were an ornery bunch. They were given to several carnal qualities that two of the ones that seem to raise their ugly heads so frequently are the qualities of pride and selfishness. They were not so much concerned about one another as they were about promoting themselves and about elevating themselves, which led to, I think, many of the problems that the apostle had to address in this letter and correct. For example, they arrogantly lined themselves up behind various teachers, which resulted in strife and division. They proudly tolerated sin among themselves and in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And in 1 Corinthians 6, they were selfishly taking one another to civil court. In the 8th, 9th, and 10th chapter, they were puffed up about their own knowledge. And as a result of that, they were walking over the consciences of weak brethren. They were not interested in, they were doing their own thing regardless of brethren's weak conscience. And they had turned in the 11th chapter, they turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal They didn't wait for one another. They didn't share the meal with one another. And it was just all because of their selfishness. And when we come to the section of our text, 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, we find that, again, it is selfish pride and a lack of concern for others that becomes the prominent problem that affects the situation that Paul is talking about in this section. You'll understand, obviously, if you've read the book of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, that it basically divides into two sections, the first section being chapter 1, verse 10, through the end of the 6th chapter, where Paul basically deals with things concerning that have been reported to him concerning the family of Chloe. And then in the 7th chapter, Paul begins to answer some questions that evidently the Corinthians had sent him. And he seems to almost consistently distinguish one topic from another with a little word formula where he says, now concerning. And almost every time you read the expression, now concerning, you'll see that Paul is going to a different subject. And of course, the section of 1 Corinthians 13 that we're looking at falls within a section, one of those now concerning sections. And it's the now concerning spiritual gifts. And contextually, I would suggest to you that he's talking about now concerning miraculous spiritual gifts. The Corinthians evidently struggled with some incorrect assumptions about the miraculous spiritual gifts, and especially the gift of tongues. They had exaggerated the importance of the gift of tongue speaking. They got to seeing it as one of, if not the most important of all the miraculous spiritual gifts. And that led them to an unwarranted desire to have that gift, to have the gift of tongues, and to use that gift in their assemblies. And those who were somehow blessed with the gift of tongues, that gift which in their view was the most prestigious of all, because they had it, they began to become puffed up and arrogant about it. And so to correct this, Paul begins in the 12th chapter telling us about the fact that God has given more than just one gift to his body. He has in fact given a variety of gifts to the members of Christ's body, just as he's done that in the physical body. The gift of tongues was a gift, but it was not the only gift. It wasn't even among the most important gifts or the greater gifts. It was one of the gifts. And the thing that is very important as you look at 1 Corinthians 12, I believe, the principle that's very important, is that he suggests that even though God certainly has given these variety of gifts to the body, but always for the common good of the whole body. And in fact, that expression for the common good seems to be the principle that directs a lot of what is said in these next in this section of the text. In Christ's body, there are a variety of functions. They're all aimed, though, at the common good of the whole church. No gift of God in any context, and particularly in this context, no gift of God is ever to be used for personal advantage. Whatever gift a person has, and especially if we're talking about a miraculous spiritual gift in the context of 1 Corinthians 13, whatever gift one has has got to be used for the common good and never for any self-willed or self-promoting reasons. Of course, Paul was not discouraging their desire or their use of miraculous spiritual gifts. He actually even encourages them to desire the greater gifts, one of which in the 14th chapter in verse 1 is identified as prophecy. Tongues is not one of them. But he goes on and says, desire the greater gifts. But, he says, I'm going to show you a more excellent way than all that. And the more excellent way turns out to be the way of love. And what I want you to first of all notice is why Paul, in this context of 1 Corinthians 13, why he talks to us about love and why it is the more excellent way, why it is a way that supersedes the miraculous and even some of the things like faith and hope. Why is that? Let's notice the reasons that Paul gives, and I would suggest that there are basically three reasons. The first reason is that love is the more excellent way than the way of the miraculous, because it is what gives value to whatever things I do. He starts out with a series of hypothetical situations or statements that are really statements of hyperbole, I believe. In other words, they're overstatement, really. Not that he's saying you can actually do these things, but he's saying even if you could do these things. And what does he say? If you could speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I've become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Paul wants us to understand that without love, everything we do is essentially worthless. It all ends up having the wrong focus. And the wrong focus very often is me. And that's not the right focus. But if what one does is an expression of genuine love, then the focus isn't on that person. It isn't on me. But it's on those that are loved. And that's important. So love is the more excellent way. It's more excellent than the exercise of any miraculous spiritual gift. It's even more excellent than any act of self-sacrifice. Because without it, because it gives value to what I do, and without it, I'm just a big boy. There is no profit. I'm still nothing. And that's what Paul says here. And so the point is, love is more excellent than the way of the supernatural, particularly in this context, because it's what gives value to what we do. Secondly, he suggests that love is the thing that will control our behavior, especially in the use of the miraculous gifts. Love is not going to allow me to use my gifts for selfish or self-promoting purposes, as was evident among the Corinthians. Rather, it acts in predictable ways that are looking out for others. And this is why Paul at this particular point talks about love and describes what love is like, what it looks like in detail, and we'll come back to it in just a minute, to help the Corinthians see that love is that which would control their behavior. It's more important, it's more excellent than the miraculous gifts, because it gives value to things, everything you do, and it's what will guide you in the use of whatever gifts you have. And as Paul goes down through there describing the various qualities, the last quality that he lists is one that allows him to transition into the last and most important, maybe, of the 3 points that Paul is making in 1 Corinthians as to why love is a more excellent way than the miraculous way of the miraculous. And that last point is that love never fails. And when Paul uses the word fail here, it's the verb to fall, pipto, I think is the Greek word. It's the word to fall, and in this particular instance, it means to fall or to cease, to fall in the sense of ceasing or dropping out of existence. And what Paul is saying is that love never drops out of existence, but contextually, he'll go on to demonstrate that it, in contrast to the miraculous spiritual gifts, that it always remains. Love always remains. It never drops out of existence. That can't be said for the miraculous spiritual gifts. He specifically says in verse 8, after he says that love never fails, he says, but if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away with. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. Paul says that the gifts are something that are going to be, done away with. And I say the gifts in general, even though Paul only lists prophecy and knowledge and the gift of tongues, because I believe he's using a figure of speech which we sometimes call synecdoche, where a part is put for the whole. These three represent all the gifts that have been earlier delineated in the overall context that has been mentioned here, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And so the point is that all of the gifts are going to ultimately be removed. And Paul not only tells us that they're going to be removed, he tells us why they're going to be removed. They're going to be removed because they only allowed a person to know in part and to prophesy in part. They only gave a person a part of God's revelation. And I would urge you, if you get the book, to read what I say about this. I'm not going to really develop this very much right now, but I try to say some stuff about that in the book. Don't buy the book just for my article, but if you happen to buy the book, give it an opportunity to, you know, take a minute sometime down the road to look at what we have to say here. I think hopefully it might be helpful to you in regard to these matters. I think probably we all ultimately agree with the conclusions. I'd like you to just see how I reach the conclusions that I do in the text. So he says that the miraculous gifts are going to be done away with because they only allow partial knowledge. But when the perfect comes, and I believe he means that when God's will is completely revealed, his revelation is completely revealed, that the partial, the gifts that enabled us only to know in part, that those would be done away with. He goes on to argue in this text quickly that just as he put away things associated with his childhood once he became a man, so also, I believe, by implication, he's suggesting that when the revelation of God is full-grown or completed, that the things necessary to bring it to completion, that those things would be removed as well. At that time, when the revelation of God is completed, we will no longer see dimly as in a mirror. That doesn't make a lot of sense to us, because when I go look in the mirror today, the mirrors we have are extremely clear, and boy, that's an ugly sight when I look in the mirror. I can see that pretty clearly. I don't like it, but I see it, okay? But in their day, mirrors were basically made of polished metal, and they would try to polish that metal up real good, and that would give them a reflection. But it was always a kind of a not crystal clear reflection of themselves. And so we won't see dimly when the completed revelation is here. We won't see dimly anymore. We will see clearly, is Paul's point. At that time, we will no longer see ourselves in that way. We'll see ourselves clearly. Of course, the Corinthians, they lived at a time before the perfect had come. And so Paul's point to them is that there's nothing wrong with them wanting the gifts, especially the greater gifts. There's nothing wrong with that. There's even nothing wrong with them using those in the assembly under certain guidelines. But they needed to understand that the miraculous spiritual gifts were only a temporary tool used by God until the time in which he had completed the revelation of his will. But when that time came, they were going to be done away with. In the meantime, they needed to understand that that love was something that was going to abide. What they needed more than anything else was not the miraculous spiritual gifts. They needed to learn how to love one another properly, because love is what would continue to abide even long after the miraculous gifts were done away with. Of course, today, our situation is somewhat different. We don't live in the same times like the Corinthians lived, and so we live at a time after the perfect has come, and so we no longer need the miraculous gifts. These gifts have all ceased, and they're no longer here, and I don't want to get into a big discussion. I know there are some who would take issue to that in denominational realms, but the point is, we believe that they're all gone. But brothers, let me suggest to you that the three things that Paul says remain, faith, hope, and love, those things are still here. And those things are important that we recognize our need for them, and especially so the greatest of these three, which is love. Now, I believe, as much as any time in the history and development of the Lord's church, there's a need for these qualities among brothers, especially the greatest of these, which is love. Now, as much as ever, as much as any other time, we must make sure that love remains among us, that love is the dominant force, a dominant force among us, and that love for our brothers is what guides our treatment of one another. And that brings us back to the description that we just kind of blipped over a moment ago when Paul talks about love in this great New Testament text. What does love really look like? I like to talk in those kinds of terms. I like to try to help people understand what something looks like. And if you want to get a picture of what love looks like, here's what love looks like according to what the Apostle Paul says in the text. He's going to describe love for us. And I want to suggest something to you very quickly, that in his describing love for us in the text, he's not doing it so that we'll know how to love God, even though love for God is an essential quality. I'm not doubting that. But he's not telling us about how to love so that we'll know how to love God. He's also not telling us, describing love in this text, so that we'll know about the love that ought to exist between a man and his wife. Even though I believe by extension, there can be certainly, and there should certainly be, application of these principles to that. He didn't write this text so we'll have something pretty to say at weddings. Paul is writing this description of love so that you and I will know what love looks like and what it ought to look like in our relationships with one another. So how does Paul describe love? What does love look like? Well, Paul starts with that description as you go back, beginning at verse 4 of 1 Corinthians 13. And he starts off by telling us that love is patient or long-tempered. It's the word that is used is macrothumia. By the way, I don't have a PowerPoint, and I'm not going to apologize for not having a PowerPoint. I'm technologically challenged, I admit it, and I would have really messed up if I'd have tried to bring a PowerPoint presentation. That might have been helpful, but I don't have one. But Paul uses he uses this word macrothumia, and it's the word, a combination word that comes from the idea of macros is the opposite of micro. And micro means little, macros means big or large or long. And the thumia word is the word from which we get our thermal words. And he says literally we're supposed to be long-tempered with one another. Someone who loves is someone who's long-tempered with those that he loves. Our throwaway society tends to say to us, you need to get rid of those hard-to-get-along-with people. Anyone or anything that's hard to get along with, you just need to get rid of it. But love won't let us do that with people. It puts up with those who are loved. It puts up with those who might be easier to just give up on. Love helps us hang in there with those kinds of folks. And I want to suggest to you that that's a lesson that we need every Christian to learn, but it is a lesson that particularly those who might be more mature in Christ need to learn. Yes, I'm saying that those who are more spiritually mature need to take special note of this particular thing, this particular quality. And the reason is that too often we are the ones who are most impatient with our brothers, especially when he shows signs of weakness. Very often we expect our brothers to become Christians and to grow up overnight. And we expect of them that in some ways. And that happens where our impatience happens with them, when their weakness is from maybe a lack of knowledge that threatens to infringe on our liberty or our right. Or it might be that their weakness is stems from their struggle to fully and finally put off some sin in their life. The fact that it keeps cropping up in their life, we get impatient with that. We say, you need to get rid of that. One of the things you need to know about me is I'm extremely flawed. I got all sorts of bumps and bumps, and I sure hope people are patient with me because I've got things in my life that I've been working for 30 years now that I've been a Christian to try to fully and finally put them away. And I get them all rescued and wrestled and I get it all put away and I think for once in my life I'm rid of that. And then sometime down the road when I least expect it, that problem crops up in my life again. And so I'm struggling with it again. And that happens to everyone. And it certainly happens to our weak brothers. And so we've got to be patient with them as they try to grow up in Christ. It would do well for us to remember that the service that God calls us to is one that we master over time. It's not one that we master immediately. We can't expect that brother to be where we are spiritually. It took us some time to get to the spiritual level that we're at, and it's going to take him some time. It may actually take him more time. I don't know. But we need to be patient with him. I know how hard it is to be patient with folks, especially those high-maintenance people that we have sometimes in local churches. We have them. I know how tough that is to be. I sometimes get out of breath thinking about how much effort it's going to take me just to keep this guy faithful. I mean, just to keep him coming to church services sometimes, which is just a small part of his service to God. But I tell you what he doesn't need. He doesn't need for me to become impatient with him and blow him off. What he needs is for me to teach him with patience, with all patience, great patience and instruction, 2 Timothy 4 and verse 2. He needs for me to love him and to love him more. And the very fact that we sometimes get impatient with our brothers suggests that we have not yet mastered love as Paul is describing it here. But Paul goes on to say that love also is kind, and he means that it is good and gracious and gentle. And I want to say something to you as nice as I should, and I meant to say something earlier. I'm going to say it right now. When I talk about these things, please understand that I am certainly aware of my failings in all of this. I'm not saying, here's what you guys need to do, and you know, I've got it all down. I don't have it all down. I'm still trying to learn to love in a more perfect way. And so when I say these things and urge us to these things, I'm not urging us to these things from the perspective of someone who's got it down. I'm urging it from the perspective of someone who is also seeking to urge himself. And the reality is, I frankly need you to help hold me accountable when I don't act as these passages of Scripture teach. And I hope that we can do that for one another. And I say that because I want us to understand that when I talk about this, I'm not saying it's you guys who need to fix it. I'm all right. I need your help to obey Scripture. I don't know if Brother Adams says, I don't know if other preachers find it, but for me, I find it's a whole lot easier to preach it than it is to live it. And so, I want you to understand that. So Paul says, love is kind. And I think we need to understand, you know what, brothers? We're just not always kind to one another. We're not always very kind to one another. I know that sometimes we get up and we say we're going to be kind, but we're not always kind. I really appreciated enjoyed the previous lecture. I don't know the brother who spoke, never met him, he doesn't know who I am. I had a disagreement with some of the points that he said, and that's for me to talk about with him. But I tell you, I appreciated what seemed to me to be a pretty decent spirit in describing those things. And I tell you, when you talk about things with a good spirit, when you're kind to one another, that's what helps me to really consider more open-mindedly what you say. What I'm hoping that my saying it kindly is what helps you to consider what I'm saying in a more open-minded way. I have a good friend, George LeMasters, who used to say, you can tell a man that he's going to hell in a way that makes him hate you for it, or you can tell a man that he's going to hell in a way that makes him love you for it. And I tell you, I'd a lot rather tell a man he's going to hell in a way that makes him love me for it. Not because I want him to love me, but because I want to help him do what's right. And if I can do it in a way that makes him love me for it, then maybe I can reach him with the message. And the reality is that sometimes we're not that. We're not kind to one another. We're harsh. We criticize one another harshly. We criticize one another sometimes unfairly. Very often, we also do it sarcastically. And I know there's a good place for sarcasm, and I use it myself, and sometimes more often than I should, but sometimes it comes across very unkind. We run over one another. We are disrespectful of one another. We're impolite to one another. And we're especially unkind on those occasions when we differ with one another. And that's why I appreciated the lesson so well this morning and the spirit in which it was given. And we're also even unkind, especially when we're pointing out the faults of one another, even legitimate faults that we should point out. Sometimes while we do that, we're not as kind as we need to be. We need to understand the principle that Paul teaches in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 24. The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth. I tell you what, that's what we're all about. We're trying to present message. We're not interested in getting people told. We're interested in trying to help people come to repentance. And that requires our presentation of what we're saying to one another. Even when we're trying to help each other change our mind about something, change our behavior about something, it requires us to be kind and gentle and that's just the quality of love, Paul says. But love also, Paul says in verse 4, does not envy. And the other versions use the word jealous. In fact, I think that's what my version uses. Yes, jealous. And that's because it's actually the original word is the Greek word zelos, which is the Greek word for jealous. It's also the word for zealous. But I want you to understand that there's one kind of envy that covets the things of others, that wants what belongs to someone else. And that's bad, but it's not the worst kind. There's another kind of envy. The worst kind of envy is the kind of envy that begrudges the other of even having it. If I can't have it, I don't want you to have it. And that's the attitude sometimes that happens among us. Our text describes the lesser of these two. It describes the first one we pointed out. But if it condemns the lesser, then it certainly condemns the worst of those two. Both of these envy and jealousy in that way, are carnal qualities. They're carnal qualities that can and do exist sometimes among us as brethren, as brothers. We may become jealous of a brother's possessions or of his friends. We may become jealous of the attention that he seems to be getting or his ability or how much he's being used. And when that happens, it clearly indicates that we do not love like we should. Love doesn't do that. It does not. It is not envious. Paul also says that love does not brag and is not arrogant. Verse 4. There is no room. There is no room for pride and arrogance and self-promotion in genuine love. People who genuinely love one another don't do that. True love does not parade itself. There are some folks who like to talk about how much they love or how many sacrifices they've made for others. You've been with some folks maybe like that who like to talk about, look at the liberties, look at what I gave up for him, or look at all the ways that I've served him. That's obvious boasting. But I want us to remember that we don't have to be so obvious to still be arrogant. You can brag behind the cloak of humility. You can pretend to be humble, appear to be humble, and yet really be bragging. Love won't let us do that. One who truly loves won't talk about his loving acts, but seeks to show love in humble ways, and in fact he is happiest when he can serve anonymously. Love also does not act unbecomingly or rudely, Paul says in verse 5. And I would suggest to you that there are many ways to be rude. You can have bad manners. I have some, I'm sure. You can interrupt sometimes. Those are bad ways. Those are ways of being rude. But this word primarily refers to inappropriate behavior that is indecent. Love doesn't act in indecent ways. Love doesn't touch or talk or look or make a pass at. Love is holy. It's pure, Paul is suggesting here. It doesn't act in an unbecoming way. He also says, and here's something that Rick Milligan needs to listen to a lot, love does not seek its own. It is not selfish and self-seeking. That's important, and that's a principle that's really displayed well, I think, in Philippians 2, verses 3 through 4. Some seem to have the attitude that that if this isn't done my way, then it's not good, then it's wrong, or it's stupid, or it's absurd for someone to think that way. Some imply, on this thing, it's either my way or you hit the highway, Jack. That's the way we sort of act with one another. Others may not be so brazenly selfish, but they try to manipulate circumstances to get their own way. And I've done that, and maybe not in really awful, ugly ways, but I know I do it sometimes. We got a situation where you're at the party, the potluck, and the sisters are over there cutting up the pie. And you're in line to get pie, you know, you want to get pie, and you're kind of close to the front, and Rick notices that the third piece of pie is the biggest one. And so what does Rick do? Well, the lady cuts the first pie, puts it on a plate, and hands it to Rick, and he generously, unselfishly, passes it along to someone else. And then the second piece is given, and he generously passes that along to someone else. And then the third piece of pie comes, the one I was wanting, and suddenly, oh, everybody's got theirs, so I'll go on with my piece of pie. And what I've done is I've manipulated circumstances out of selfishness. That may be sort of silly and cute in a situation like that. My wife doesn't like me behaving that way, but it's certainly not cute when it becomes really serious matters. Love doesn't do that. It never demands its own way. It never manipulates situations for personal gain. It always bows to the interests of others. If I love someone, I will set aside my plans and my agendas and my rights for the good of the one loved. The point is that like Jesus, whose love was sacrificial and whom I desperately want to be like, my love for others must also be self-sacrificing. It must be for all of us. Paul goes on in verse 5 to say that love is not provoked. You know, there's some folks that can aggravate us. and that can frustrate us and rub us wrong. Everywhere I've ever been, there's been some brother in the church who, you know, just sort of rubs me a little wrong. We have folks like that, and if you're one of my close friends, don't try to think that maybe you're him. I'm not saying that. But we have those people in our lives that sometimes frustrate us. But love helps us keep a check on our tempers. It helps us keep a check on our tempers so that we don't get ticked off at the guy, even though he may be frustrating to us. It helps us so that we don't get angry and sin. It even keeps us from being overly sensitive or too touchy about the words and actions of others. And that's another way in which love is not easily provoked. And that's something I think we are so super sensitive, some of us. And every time you turn around, you know, a person is getting their feelings hurt. And love doesn't allow ourselves to be provoked like that. Love also, Paul says in verse 5, takes no account of wrong suffered. And here he uses an accountant's term, describing the accountant who lists things in a ledger for the purpose of remembering it, so it won't be forgotten. And the idea is that love doesn't hold a grudge. People can act like accountants, you know. We're not supposed to hold a grudge. We're not supposed to keep a mental record of every hurt a brother causes me. And yet, often, that happens in the Lord's church. It happens. Far too often it happens. To our shame, we admit that it happens far too often. We need desperately to learn how to, as sometimes it's said, bury the hatchet without leaving the handle out. We need to learn to bury it all. Learning to love is going to help us learn to take no account for evil. Love also, Paul says, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but it rejoices in the truth. The godly love that is described in our text has nothing to do with evil and everything to do with what is good and wholesome and upright. There are some folks who rejoice at the unrighteousness of others. They are glad to see him sin. They knew he would fail. In fact, they kind of wanted him to fail. And that's obviously not right. Others don't actually rejoice in another person's sin. In fact, they seem to do almost the opposite, but their actions amount essentially to the idea of rejoicing in someone else's sin. That happens, for example, when a person harbors a sinner or tries to gloss over his sin or tries to help him hide his sin in some ungodly way. Something that was happening in 1 Corinthians 5 among the Corinthian Christians. Love, however, motivates us to try to restore the person in the right way. It demands that we do whatever it takes to get the guy back. Galatians 6 and 1 is a passage that teaches us that. Certainly we do it with kindness. Certainly we do it with patience. But we do it, and that's the important thing we need to recognize. Some become impatient and unkind, while others of us are too tolerant and dismiss sin too easily, and there needs to be a balance. Paul goes on and says, love bears all things. As a brother, it bears and endures all things that a brother might do to us. It bears and endures any hurt he may cause us, any disappointment he may bring to us. It bears and endures those kinds of things. When we love, we recognize the failings and the faults of other people. I've jumped ahead here. Love accepts every hardship or any rejection. Love keeps us going at the same intensity to build up and encourage. And so finally then Paul says, I need to kind of hurry here. Love, he says, also believes all things, and love hopes all things. And that doesn't mean that we're blind or naive. When we love someone, we will recognize our brother's faults or his failings, but we won't believe or think the worst about him. Instead, we'll hope for the best in what he might become. Instead of thinking the worst about what happens, we'll put the best interpretation on what he says. We'll put the best interpretation on his mood or on something that he says or something that he does. Instead of thinking the worst, or he must be mad at me, or he must be thinking this, we will put the best interpretation because we believe in our brothers. Love makes us believe in our brothers. Are we sure that the motive or the intent that we have assigned him is the correct one? Are we sure about that? Is the way that you've interpreted his deed, is that the only way to see it? Is there a better way to see it? Love believes the best. Love hopes the best. Love never fails. It never stops. It always remains. And of course, the practical question then that we have to ask ourselves is, are we making sure that love always remains among us? Is love really a dominant force among us in the Lord's church? Is it the dominant force that actually guides the treatment we have of one another? And as we think about whether or not it actually does that, we have to remember the definition that Paul gives of love here in the text, because that's the way God sees what love looks like. So does our love that we claim to have for one another, does it actually look like the love that Paul describes here in the text? I want to suggest to you quickly as I close that in our generation and in the generations just prior to ours, there has been a noble quest among us in what we call churches of Christ. It's a restoration quest. We have honestly, been trying to restore New Testament Christianity to our world. We've been trying to reproduce in our generation what we read about in the pages of God's completed revelation. And I will tell you this, that I personally owe a great deal of debt to men who have gone before me who have contributed a whole lot more to that effort, that noble quest, than I have. I, in fact, see myself only as the beneficiary of the work that these men have done, and I appreciate it so much. But as I try to evaluate where we are now and where we yet need to go as we continue the pursuit of this noble quest, I feel that we've done a lot. I feel that we've done pretty well in regards to restoring New Testament Christianity when it comes to doctrinal things. Not that we've already arrived or that we know everything there is to know. We don't. And when we begin to think that way, we're in trouble. We will never know everything. We are always, forever going to be disciples, learners, who must keep on learning and who must keep on studying. But in general, I think that much of what we teach seems to be consistent in general with the pattern or the standard of sound words revealed in the New Testament, 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 13. And I think that's a great thing. But brothers, we will not have completely restored New Testament Christianity until we restore the kind of personal character and the relationships with one another that Jesus teaches us to have. It is not just New Testament doctrine that must be restored. It's not merely the New Testament church and its organization or whatever that must be reproduced. Sure, those terms, doctrine and church, those terms can and maybe should be broadly interpreted to encompass the whole of what New Testament Christianity is all about. But far too often these terms are limited in our scope. We tend to reduce doctrines to the right position on some religious subject. And as a people, and I would say that we preachers too, we are far more sectarian and denominational in our thinking and in our view of the church than we'd care to admit. I believe that's true of us all. No, it's not just New Testament doctrine or the New Testament church in our limited sense that's got to be restored. The quality of our character and the relationships that Jesus teaches us to have must be restored as well. And efforts to restore New Testament Christianity will not be finished until we have reached those objectives too. And of course, at the foundation of that character and that the relationships we're supposed to have, at the root of that is this quality that we've been discussing, the quality of love, which more than any other quality, character quality, I believe, will enable us to truly be the disciples of Jesus Christ. Because, listen, folks, if I read my Bible right, it is not our distinctive doctrines that are supposed to identify us to the people of the world that we are indeed the followers of Christ. It is our distinctive relationship with one another. It is the fact that we love one another. Jesus said, hereby they will know that you are my disciples. Not by your distinctive doctrines. Yes, we teach distinctive things. We try to teach what the Bible says. And that's different from what everybody else says. But the thing that people are going to notice first, the thing that they should notice first, is a relationship that we have with one another that is rooted in love. They should be able to look at us and say, oh, how they love each other. And I believe that that's something we really need to work on. We don't have to look real hard at us as a whole, at how splintered we are, and how suspicious we are of each other, and how unkindly we treat one another at times, to see that we've still got a lot of work to do on restoring New Testament Christianity. Because our relationships with one another, the love that we have for one another, the kind of character that Jesus says we're supposed to have, isn't there yet. And so I would suggest to you that it might be good for all of us, that we might be, do us all a great bit of good, if individually and collectively, if we all go home and maybe turn off our computers and lay down our religious periodicals and stop analyzing each other's positions and turn off for a minute being in the debate mode and start looking at ourselves personally in light of the Bible, at the qualities of our own character, and especially at the quality of our love. And having done that, it might be good for each one of us individually to start focusing our time and our energies on learning how to be more like Jesus, especially in the way we love. And I would suggest to you that maybe then, when we've truly learned to love one another, maybe then we can really help each other to all believe the same thing and to practice the same thing. And maybe then the world will begin to see us as the true people of God. Thank you for listening.